We're going to call the meeting of the Higher Ed and Workforce Development Policy and Finance Division to order. Okay, we're going to actually, Chair Rukavina is just running late, so we're going to move ahead with starting with House File 1252. Representative Murphy is here to present that bill. And we do not yet have a quorum, so we will just go ahead and begin with that.
Circle around and come in twice.
Hi, Doctor.
This is going to now.
All right, Representative Murphy, would you like to make a motion regarding this bill?
I move that House File 1252 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Workforce Development Bill.
Thank you very much. And welcome all to the committee, and you may go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, this fall in northeastern Minnesota, the area organization for the deaf and blind had a meeting in which they invited the legislators. And I went. And at this meeting, it was kind of an open forum where the people were there. We're talking about their problems with state government and problems that they had in society, problems that they had with the media, problems in every respect. And in a way, it was a place for them to just to vent to each other. But I listened very carefully. And I had been to a meeting much smaller than this about 5 years before. And I saw the development that had taken place and the tone of the issues that they brought to our attention had certainly changed from a personal level to we've got to bring attention to more people. And especially, they pointed out, the problems that they had with law enforcement community and the personal trials and tribulations they had if they were ever stopped while driving. And as a result of that meeting, then I was approached by Mary, who is a board member, to carry this bill. And I thought, truly, this was a statewide bill. But reading the bill, it's not. But this consortium of 13 school districts in the western suburbs is the only organization which is providing training for the transition deaf and hard of hearing student from age 18 to 21. And as a result, it is truly a statewide bill because people from all over the state come and asked to get in the program that the consortium of 13 school districts are providing. I'm not going to talk anymore because I've given you the background, but Greta Palmberg is here, and Sandy Lewandowski is here. But most important, we have to have time for Martha Davies to talk because she's a real person that's receiving the services. She has come from Africa to Minnesota. She's a resident of Minnesota now. And her story is just wonderful. But I suppose we've got to listen to these other people first. Greta Palmberg.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I just want to thank Representative Mary Murphy for being the author of this legislation and helping young adults who are deaf.
Would you just state your name, too,
please? Sure, I'm sorry. Greta Palmberg. This legislation that helps young deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind students get jobs and keep them.
I've been an educator for 20 years, but I'm also a mother of a deaf son. And I've gone through my own transition with him. He graduated from high school last year and is attending his first year of college. I currently work at the Vector Transition Services. It's a two-year program for young adults with disabilities. And we have approximately one-third of our students that are deaf or hard of hearing. I'm here before you today to ask for funding to pay the cost of interpreters for the Vector Transition Program. Schools see our district and Vector as a wise investment. Over the last 5 years, 95% of our deaf and hard of hearing graduates were competitively employed or enrolled in post-secondary programs at the time of their graduation. Vector began from a federal grant in 1985, and it's nationally recognized as an exemplary school-to-work model. Yet, our program is at risk of folding. While school districts have been pleased with the results, the additional cost of serving deaf, hard of hearing students has caused them to pull students out of the program or not refer them at all. It costs an average of $20,000 extra per student a year to cover the interpreting costs for on-the-job training, post-secondary experiences, and transition training. We are hoping that DEED will partner with us to help deaf and hard of hearing students gain access to these services that increase employment rates. By contrast, the national averages for the deaf and hard of hearing young adults are dismal, including high unemployment, underemployment, low rates of full-time employment, and low rates of participation in post-secondary. As a matter of fact, it's estimated that 75% of deaf, hard of hearing that go to college never graduate. Vector provides literacy, self-advocacy skills, work skills, and help in the post-secondary area. So what is the outcome of such a specialized program, and how much money can it save the state? Well, to give you an example, one of our students at Deaf at Vector who recently graduated went right into the workforce. While at Vector, he was receiving $630 a month in Social Security benefits, $90 in food stamps, and received MA insurance. After graduation, Vector helped him place him in a job. He's currently making $14 an hour with full benefits. As for job retention, he's been there over 2 years now. He's off SSI, off food stamps, and off MA. We would like to see these results continue. We would like our 95% success rate to continue for our deaf and hard of hearing students.
Thank you. And
Martha Davies is here.
Very good. Martha, just go ahead.
Mrs. Chair, members of this committee, my name is Martha Davies, and I am a student of the Vector program. I came to America in 2004. I am from Sierra Leone in West Africa. Before I lived in Africa, there was no education for deaf and hard of hearing students there. There was no interpreters. The teachers always spoke, and we never understood what they were saying at all while they were trying to teach us. We would even ask them, "What are you saying?" And they would pretty much say and ignore us and not respond to us. So we had no idea what they were teaching in class. And then the war happened in my country, and we escaped to another state called Gambia. And so we stayed there for a while, for about 5 years, and there was absolutely no education there and no possibility of getting a job. And when we moved to America, my family decided amongst ourselves what was the best school for me when we arrived here. And so when we got here, we looked into District 287 and the Vector program, and I took a few classes while I was there. And I saw one woman walk by me, and she was signing, and I signaled to her. I said, "Wow, my name is Martha Davies. Are you deaf?" And the woman responded saying, "No, I'm a hearing interpreter." And to me, I'm like, oh, my gosh, to be able to see that woman sign. And I just started crying because I've never experienced an interpreter before in my life. So it was just a great time for me to actually meet someone like that. Anyway, when I was in the Vector program taking classes, I took American Sign Language classes. I learned the language. I met so many new people from this program. And before, I had never actually even known what money meant. American dollars, I didn't know what a dollar meant to me. And so my mother used to give me $3, and I'm like, oh, okay, that sounds great to me. But while I was taking some financing business classes at the Vector program, I learned what these things were. And I understood American money so much better, and I got the opportunity to work at a store as a cashier, and I learned what things cost. And when I did go home and my mother tried to give me $3 again, I said, no way, that money is just not enough for me. My mom was so surprised and impressed that I had learned that so quickly. She said, wow, you just picked that up right away. So I was still so proud of myself, though, that District 287 was able to help me improve my skills in that area. I did actually also learn English. I learned how to read and write. In Africa, again, there was no job experience possibility for me whatsoever. And now with the Vector program, I have that opportunity. I had the opportunity to experience a variety of things. I got to work at a beading store. I got to work at Norell. And I also had the opportunity to work at Courage North Camp in northern Minnesota for deaf adults. And then I decided to take a printing class at Hennepin Technical College. I wanted to be in that program because I wanted that for my future job. I was very interested in the printing program, so I did take that class, and I learned what it meant to be on the job, what it took, what the paper process was, and all the equipment that goes along with it. And the interpreter was there to guide me along with the vocabulary and how that was set up. And in May, I will graduate with a certificate in the printing program from Hennepin Technical College. And I can't imagine, 3 years ago when I first arrived in America, I had such limited English, such limited skills. And now my signing is still getting there. I'm still learning. But this year I will graduate from the Vector program in June and also Hennepin Technical College in May. And my future, I want to start a full-time job after I do graduate and having a job in printing. And Mrs. Chair and members of this committee, I just want to thank you for your time today and allowing me to speak with you. I hope you support this bill. And again, thank you to the Vector program for allowing me and just really changing my life. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And Representative Murphy, I do agree that Martha Davies is well worth the testimony. She did a wonderful job. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And she told me that for both of her graduations, she will have a cake.
Very good. She deserves one. Are there any questions?
May I introduce Sandra Lewandowski, who is the superintendent of schools for District 287.
Yes, thank you. Okay. Are there any questions? Actually, we now have a quorum. Oh, yes.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering how many interpreters are available to be hired. Is there a shortage?
Well, here in the metro, Madam Chair, members and members of the committee, here in the metro, we're fortunate that we do have a good pool of interpreters, and currently we have 9 full-time interpreters that are hired by District 287 for this program only.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, statewide, do you think, is there a shortage of interpreters in other programs?
I think in the rural areas, it's still difficult to find interpreters.
Thank you.
All right, other questions? Otherwise, we do have a quorum now. So Representative Murphy will restate her motion.
I renew my motion to that House File 1252 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Workforce Development Bill.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. I have a question for you about House File 1252. It does state that the money would be appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Health. Is that accurate, or is that, did you want the Commissioner of Deed, or?
The Commissioner of Deed.
So perhaps we need to amend the bill.
Will you help me?
Madam Chair and members, on page 1, line 6, delete the word health and insert employment and economic development.
That's exactly what I wanted.
Okay. All those in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Okay, the amendment passes. All right. Do we have any other comments, questions? All in favor of House File 1252 as amendment? Well, we don't need to vote because now we can just carry it forward. So thank you very much, Representative Murphy. Representative Reinert, are you prepared at this point? Or? We're going to move to House File 1338. Representative Reinert moves that House File 1338 be recommended to pass for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you for making that motion for me, Madam Chair. There is a delete all amendment that should have been handed out to you for this.
And that bill is listed as AO70153?
Yes.
Thank you.
So the delete all contains the full text of the original bill, but the difference is that the description of the appropriation in each year now includes directive language for deed in terms of how the funds will be administered, and that language, deed was consulted in the formulation of that language.
So you will now move that delete all amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay.
Are there any, okay, I could speak
now,
just a
now
little.
We will have you just go ahead and speak to that, please.
Okay, I'll speak a little further to the amendment and then to the whole bill. Well, I'll just speak to the whole bill with the amendment included. the bill is seeking a funding increase of $1 million, first, which matches the governor's request. The year previous to this, $1 million was added to the deed budget on a one-time only, and the governor's budget also seeks to make that permanent in the base. So that first part of the request matches the governor's, but in addition to that, we're seeking $1.25 million over the biennium for the extended employment program. And the change in the appropriation directive merely states that up to 3% of the funds over the old $1 million will be used for a cost of living adjustment, and the remainder of the increase will go to the distribution to the extended employment program as it is currently listed in statute. So that's the broad explanation of the bill. Then I'd just like to say a little bit about the extended employment program. We have heard from participants in the extended employment program earlier on this committee, and you may notice you have this orange handout, which our testifier will speak to later, but Jeff on the far side of that foldout spoke to us earlier this session about his experience in the extended employment program. Extended employment is over 40 years old and is a program unique to Minnesota. Almost every service provider for extended employment belongs to an organization called MACRO, the Minnesota Association of Community Rehabilitation Organizations. MACRO's current president, Pam Year, is a constituent of mine and the director of MRCI, which stands for Mankato Rehabilitation Center Incorporated. And although it stands for Mankato Rehabilitation Center, there are numerous sites in southern Minnesota as well as one site in the southern Twin Cities area. Briefly, Pam was going to be with us for testifying when the bill was up on Thursday, but she's out of town and not able to be. But I still wanted to comment on this. Just as a little background, MRCI is a highly regarded program in the Mankato area. And most people in my community know someone who is either employed through MRCI or who employs MRCI workers. Pam Year was recognized this year by Connect Magazine, and I can pass this around if you're interested, but she's on the front cover. Connect is a business magazine for Southern Minnesota, as the Businesswoman of the Year for 2006 for her work as director of MRCI. The year before, 2005, the honor went to a local employer who hires Pam's workers, someone most of you probably know in another context, Glenn Taylor of Timberwolves fame. past legislator, and owner of Taylor Corp. Glenn's company has relied on extended employment workers for many years with great success. So with that background, I'd like to introduce our testifier today, Steve Ditchler, another MACRO member, the director of PROACT and EGAN. Steve will provide a brief overview of just how the extended employment program works.
Yes, for the record, my name is Steve Ditchler, and besides being the director of PROACT, a MACRO member, I do have a couple other roles that give me a unique perspective on the extended employment funding. I am a member of the Governor's Workforce Development Council. I'm the current chair of the State Rehabilitation Council, and I'm on the board, the Workforce Investment Act board for Dakota Scott County, and also a former employee of MRCI in southern Minnesota and the Metro. The extended employment program is rather unique. You have a program that's serving a roughly 6,000 individuals with severe disabilities in employment, and the cost is just under $12 million. It's a real bargain at this point. The services are delivered through community rehabilitation programs that are located throughout the state. As noted, many programs have multiple sites, so it would be highly unlikely that there's not a program that impacts your community or a community near you. MACRO represents 23 of 27 providers of extended employment. The way it's been working, I think MACRO members have been social entrepreneurs before that was popular. From the start, one of the ways they've earned part of their budget money is by contracting with employers to provide employees with disabilities and perform work. One of the beauties of extended employment money is that it leverages other money to deliver services, thus keeping the cost to taxpayers low. The ratio is about 4-1, so every dollar of extended employment money to an EE provider generally is earning three other dollars to generate the revenue. So it's a real good value that way. In addition, the another side savings is that without these services, some of these individuals would be served in more expensive programs, costing taxpayers more money. The way it works, and I've got loosely follow this, since I'm a fill-in, I can get away with loosely. We will start off with an assessment, an individual employment plan's delivered or developed for an individual, and we're providing counseling, case management, job development, job placement, and support in that job. One of the unique parts of extended employment, it provides long-term supports for people that need them. If they don't need them, we don't provide them. The ultimate goal would take somebody that needs supports to a point where they're competitively employed in the community and no longer need supports. And that happens with a percentage of our people. Obviously, there's some people that need ongoing supports for a longer period of time. Another one of the uniqueness of this program is that it is a pay for performance. Extended employment funds pay for results, not for efforts. That's a clear distinction from some of the other funding sources. EE providers get paid when they deliver an hour of work, not for trying to get work, not for trying to keep the person in a job, but for delivering on that. I think that's a key factor. All the funding that goes through there is done on that basis. The program has been very successful. It is a little unique to Minnesota, but as the brochure would say, 65% of individuals with severe disabilities work in Minnesota compared to the national average of 49%. That's something as a state we're proud of, but on the other hand, there are also many other individuals with disabilities who want to work and can work. They just need the supports to do so. And when you look at that and the impending work shortage from the retirement of many baby boomers, not only do they want to work and can work, Minnesota needs them to work to be competitive. So there's many aspects of the funding that's important. So, I can look at the benefits of the extended employment program in terms of dollars and cents, and they earn wages and they're taxpayers instead of using the system. But I think more importantly to me is what it does to an individual's self-esteem, feeling of self-worth, self-contribution, and the ramifications of all that far exceed the individual whose lives we touch with that extended employment program. They have parents, they have extended families. And I know we don't have anybody at this hearing to testify to that, but I can assure you from being with families and extended families that stories they would tell you would bring an emotional response. Absolutely. It is employment for people with disabilities is extremely impactful, far beyond the dollar value. And like I said, the extent goes beyond the individual. And so I would, I might be getting the hook here. I can be passionate about the subject, but I will, maybe one other comment. The other side of it is I've been in many roles within the system over the years, and one of them was developing job sites, including some of the Glenn Taylor corporations. And I can assure you this is a win for business as well. They can use that workforce effectively. It's important to them. So there is a positive economic impact for this. So it's really a win-win-win. And we've got a win for the state taxpayers. It's certainly beneficial to the individuals with disabilities who are served. And it serves our businesses through employment for these people that otherwise wouldn't be included in the workforce. So it is an important workforce tool. So I would encourage you, for all those reasons, to support this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to present today.
Thank you very much.
Well, Representative Bryan. Mr. Ditchler has done a good job of summarizing the reasons for supporting that, so I'll just drop my closing remarks. I wasn't meaning to give him the impression that I was giving him the hook, but we would stand for questions if there are any.
All right. Are there any questions?
Other than where did you find such a good testifier?
Yes, excellent.
As a stand-in.
I'm telling you, if I could bring a client, it's far more compelling than me.
No. Representative Detmer?
We did hear.
And I'm sure, yeah, this is, I think, one of the first groups that came in and asked for a lesson, what the governor is proposing for this.
We're actually asking for more. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'll tell you what. You're probably looking, excuse me, Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Representative Reiner.
You're looking at the total for the whole extended employment program, which includes the basic program and the mental illness portion. And this request simply applies to the basic extended employment program.
I take that back.
All right. Any other questions? Okay. Then,
Representative. Could I add a comment? I made it some. Whenever you get up here and talk like this, you leave things out, and I left many out. However, I do want to stress that extended employment programs serve a variety of people, including people with mental health issues, mental illness. So there are providers that also participate in earning some of that severe and persistent mental illness money too, as well as individuals with traumatic brain injury, physical disabilities, etc. So if you want any more information about programs, there's a complete listing of the members on the back, and I'm sure somebody would be within your district that could further discuss the program, have you out for a tour.
Madam Chair, if I might just offer a clarification, the reason that the mental illness program is not addressed here and that Representative Clark's bill addressing it has been pulled is this issue is addressed in Representative Greiling's comprehensive mental health bill. So,
all right. Thank you. Okay. So Representative Reinhart is we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. So thank you. And we will move to House File 254, Representative Mahoney. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would you like to move your
I'd like to move House File 254 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you.
House File 254 is a bill that deals with Twin City Rise. It's an organization, and I won't try to explain too much of it, although it's been explained to me a number of times when I've seen it in committee over the last few years. It's a very great, it's a good organization, does a great job. I'm going to introduce Mr. Mike Bingman. I'm always bad with names, so if I've mangled it even that easy of a name. He's the CEO of Twin City Rise, and Andre Kovet. He is a client, and I think he's an employee of Rise at the present time to speak. So I won't take up any more time. I'll turn the microphone over to these two gentlemen to talk about what Twin City Rise does.
If you would just introduce yourself with your name and then go ahead.
Hello, I'm Mike Bingham, president of Twin Cities Rise.
Andre Corbin, employer and participant of Twin Cities Rise.
We also have a couple more folks affiliated with the program here. Henry Todd Van Dellen is our lobbyist. Some of you may remember Henry. And Kathy Lawrence, our development director. I'm just going to give a few comments to overview what we are, and then I'm going to hand it over to Andre. Twin Cities Rise is a job training program focused on people in the inner city of Minneapolis and St. Paul, mostly on African Americans. About 65% of those people we serve are what we call native-born African Americans, but all comers can come to the program. We serve individuals in very deep economic poverty. About two-thirds of the people who come to us are unemployed at the time. And we place them into jobs that average about $25,000 a year in salary plus health care benefits. So we are a program seeking placement into living wage jobs, not entry or first-level jobs. And also, we have traditionally, we've had an office in Minneapolis and one in St. Paul, and we've just opened two new offices, one in each city, focused on very younger men, age 17 to 25 or so, that are actively involved in the drug and gang lifestyle. And that's part of our growth strategy. Very quickly, I'm going to refer to this document right here. It's in our annual report, and it's a one-page overview on who we are. So if you see our annual report there, which is got pictures of some of our grads on the cover, you can just pull out this document and follow with me. Very quickly, who we serve. As I said, it's mostly African Americans. 50% of the people we serve have a criminal record, 75% have an history of alcohol and substance abuse, and most are unemployed when they come to us. Although these are adults, and they almost all have GEDs or high school diplomas, when they come to us, they test at an average 7th, 8th grade for math and reading. The contract we have with the state of Minnesota is innovative in that we only get paid when we get somebody out of poverty and they stay on the job for at least a year. So as opposed to being paid for the actual training of the individual, we are paid for the successful outcome. So we submit invoices to Deed on a regular basis for individuals who got a job that paid at least $10 an hour and had at least health care benefits. So it's a pay for outcomes or pay for performance versus a pay for the actual training itself. The way we handle the rest of our funding is through fees we get from employers for placing grads there or through traditional fundraising. So the state only accounts for approximately 12% of our revenue. The rest we raise privately. So it's we're a very leverageable program from that perspective. We've used that information. I'm continuing down here on point three here of our state contract. We've used information provided to us by the state demographer, and we've shown a 70% return on investment in the dollars given to us to date by the state, and that will go up as grads continue to work. So that return on investment is simply the taxes paid by our grads and the reduced use of social services like the prison system and like Section 8 housing and other social services. So, and the reason the difference between the 70 and 400% is most of our grads will work for 20 or 30 years. So all the benefit comes in the later years where the expense comes initially. The contract during the last biennium has worked well. As you see, point four there, the average grad increased their income from $5,900 to $24,150 plus health care benefits. So we are substantially changing people when they come to us. This is not a job placement program. This is a job training program. Think of it as a junior college level investment for individuals who cannot function in a junior college setting. I mentioned the state only accounts for a small portion of our budget, and the state only pays for the highest level of graduates we have. So we have lots of different graduates, but the state only pays for grads that achieve the outcome I've listed here, the significant change in income. Going down to the third to last point, there are proposal. We think this is an innovative contract. We think it can be used in other forms of job training in terms of the pay for outcomes only versus the pay for training. And we'd like to see the contract expanded significantly over the coming biennium because of the fact that we are growing at a pretty substantial clip and the two new offices we're opening focused on younger men. Finally, as with most long-term job training programs, at the bottom of the page there's always a question, well, are there cheaper ways to do this? There certainly are cheaper expense ways to do it. You can focus in on shorter-term job training programs and spend less. I would argue that the real number you're looking here for, though, is not the cost for the program. That's an important one, but the most important number is what is the outcome of the graduates of the program? Do they truly become taxpaying citizens? Are they truly off the public welfare rolls? So I would urge the committee to look at return on investment. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Andre, and then we'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And just before you begin, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just going to, because we have some students here, I'd just like to introduce the ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. They are participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. So welcome to the committee. Just wanted to announce that. Sorry to interrupt your presentation. So we'll just go ahead. Mr. Corbin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andre Corbett, and I will talk real briefly about my background and how Twin Cities Rise has played such a huge and dramatic role in my life. I grew up with only my mom and brother, no dad around. I moved out when I was 16 because my mom had got hooked on drugs, and I decided, you know, to move out and do my own thing. Ended up dropping out of high school in the 10th grade, and even though I went back and graduated, I got into some trouble with the law. I ended up catching a robbery case, and it was one that I did, two of them that I did not do, and ended up going to prison for 3.5 years behind it. And I heard about Twin Cities Rise while I was incarcerated at MCF Faribault through their Project Reentry Program. And they had facilitators come in and teach the empowerment class. And empowerment in that setting, it really helped boost my self-confidence and self-esteem and how I was dealing with various issues about being incarcerated. I didn't have any support system when I was released. And Twin Cities Rise, you know, has been my support system for once I got out. But with the empowerment curriculum, what it has taught me was to really respect myself and respect the values that other people have. You know, when I was 16 and when I was younger, I got involved in the gangs and drug dealing and carrying pistols and everything crazy like that. And that's not the person who I was. And the empowerment really has enabled me to look within inside myself, to tap into that person I was as a child, the one who went to school, who got the good grades, who wasn't influenced by so many negative things. I've completed the Twin Cities Rise, the Tremaine training program, in about 4 months, and I will be at my one-year retention on May the 3rd, so I'm really proud of that. And right now, my job title at Twin Cities Rise is Program Associate for our Wally Place, and I'm also training to be an empowerment instructor. And with the empowerment piece, empowerment really boosts the self-confidence and self-esteem that so many of us do not have, because our whole lives we've been told that we're not going to accomplish anything, that we're not going to be anything, that we're going to be just like our parents were, who they did the best that they could do, but it's not, they didn't maximize the fullest potential. So right now, today, you know, I'm fully gainfully employed. And as far as the return on investment, before in the past, I've gotten all my, when I filed taxes, I got all of my money back. But this year, I'm actually proud to say that I paid like $3,400. So that return on investment is already coming back, you know, two members of the committee. And in the 3.5 years I was incarcerated, I've cost taxpayers over, you know, $100,000. So to be able to give back, you know, even though I cried and complained at first, but you know, investing in programs like these, you know, is where my tax money, you know, has went, and I'm real proud of that. It's just the important piece for me is empowerment, you know, and the impact that it has on individuals' lives. And I can't say that enough, because it is so important, because besides the hard skills for the job that a lot of programs focus on, we need to focus on the soft skills about how to get along well with people, and that's what empowerment does. And right now I'm taking three college classes at Minneapolis Community College. One of them is interpersonal communications, and the other one is human relations and team building. And it's interesting because going through the books, when you consolidate it all, you get the full course of empowerment within those two books that we're giving to people. And that's the piece that I have to say.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mahoney.
We can stand for questions, but before, I'd just like to add in that this is an increase from their funding from last year. This group, Twin City Rise, serves approximately 600, and what they're looking for is the ability to almost double those numbers. And most of the growth will come in their 17 to 25 gang and drug-related people. I will call them people. And this is just the group that we have to reach, and at the age that we have to reach them at before they get into so much trouble that there is not much hope of getting them back out. Members, I think we can stand for any questions that you may have, or otherwise I'll renew the motion.
All right. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if there's a relationship between your organization and the one in Anoka County, RISE. And my understanding of the one in Anoka County is they do somewhat of different type of, they serve a different clientele. But I didn't know if there was an organizational relationship between the two entities.
No, there's not. The one in Anoka County is RISE, Inc., and they tend to serve individuals with disabilities. The only relationship is we have similar sounding names.
All right.
Okay. I did forget to mention also, most of our graduates go to work in corporate America, so Target, SuperValue, Wells Fargo, all clients. Andre, we hired ourselves. So we have about 35 employees, and about five are graduates of the program, just to clarify that.
Very good. Thank you. And Representative Severson? Representative Portman.
Oh, it's a new question.
Okay. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question of two questions. The first one is, what is your main source? I mean, how do people find out about the program and get included into the program?
Thank you. Mr. Bingham?
Multiple sources. I would say the single largest source is word of mouth of current students. They'll refer friends and family members, and then probably after that it's jails. We actually do some of our programming prior to release. That's how we hooked up with Andre. So Faribault, Ramsey County, and then other social service programs will refer to us.
Representative Severson.
And just to follow up, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you interface at all with Teen Challenge?
Yes, we do. We will get referrals from Teen Challenge for individuals who completed the inpatient component of their program and now are ready to move into the community. Many of those individuals do not have appropriate job skills, so we will get referrals from them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Portman.
Well, first, before I ask my question, can I ask, am I the only one who smells cigarette smoke in here right now?
I just
want to say something out loud because this happens in these ground floor level committee hearing rooms, and I know we have a lot of staff and we have a lot of members who smoke in the parking ramp of the state office building, and there's air intake places in two areas, and those happen to be the two areas where the smokers congregate. So if you have friends who smoke in the parking ramp, please let them know that we don't like their smoke in our hearing rooms. But the question I want to ask is, you have 600 clients at a time, or is that how many clients have gone through the program?
That's the number of people we'll serve in any given year. So at any given time, we have about 100 to 150 individuals in the program. The program has a very high churn rate the first 6 to 8 weeks of the program, because we're dealing with people with very, very unstable lifestyles, unstable housing, alcohol and drug issues.
And how long has the program been in place, and do you know how many people you've served total?
We've been in place for about 13 years, and we've just hit scale the last 3 or 4 years. Before that, we were relatively small. So I would say the number of people we've served in total would be close to about 3,000 to 4,000. Now, to clarify, we'll serve 600 people, but we won't succeed with all those 600. As I said, there's a very large churn in the program because of the population we're serving.
Thank you. I actually have a question. You talked about tracking or that you don't get paid until after at least a year has gone by. How successful are you at truly being able to track long-term like that, a year out or 2 years out?
We're very successful at tracking for 2 years. So each student who takes our program signs an agreement that they'll report back to us their job status and income for the first year. So the first year, it's contractual, and you get about 99% compliance. Year two, it's a little harder, but we probably get about 80-85% compliance. And our view is it's critical to track for that duration, because in a job training program, all the investment's up front, mm-hmm. and unless the individuals actually stay on the job, you can very quickly go from a positive return on investment to a negative one very quickly. So we want to know. And we have about 71% two-year job retention, 84% one-year job retention, which our clients report to us is higher than they're getting from hiring from pro staff or other agencies. And we just attribute that to the fact that people are with us a long time, and we work on their foundational issues, as Andre has talked about. We just don't polish somebody up on the outside. We really get inside and work on the internal issues.
Thank you, Mr. Vigan. Next we have Representative Norton.
Chair Poppe, members and testifiers, I stepped out for a moment, so you may have stated this, but could you just let me know, is this just in Minneapolis-St. Paul area, Twin Cities area, or is this statewide?
At this point, it's the 7-county metro area. About 50% of our students come from the core cities, and another 50% come from first-ring suburbs, and then a few will come from outer suburbs. But we do not have offices outside the Twin Cities. We do have expansion plans over the next 5 to 10 years to move to other core urban areas. We're really known as an urban program. That's our core skill and what we know how to do.
Representative Norton.
Being from urban Rochester, Chair Poppe, I just could see this fitting in our community as well, and just was looking to see if you were, and I appreciate hearing that you're considering expanding.
Yeah, and I would be happy if there's some community leaders who would like to have some initial discussions. I'd be happy to have those.
And I'm very happy to have another urban member in the legislature.
I just have another question, Mr. Bingham, and you perhaps have talked about this a little bit, but how is your funding actually totally the full package? What is the, because you don't get everything from the state, so how does it work that you're able to maybe put forth some money in the front end in order to be able to capture it later in the...
If you look at our total budget this year is about $3.2 million, so the state gives us up to $300,000. That's capped. The rest of the money is either from fees that employers pay us when we place somebody there, which is back-end loaded. It can be, we actually do a fair amount of training with other nonprofits who we share with them some of our curriculum. And we're working with schools now, actually. We just had a very extensive meeting with St. Paul Public Schools. But the vast majority of the money is raised the old-fashioned way. It's just from individuals, corporations, and foundations who give us outright grants. And we do have two major foundations, the St. Paul Foundation and the Fry Foundation, that pay us matching dollars for every dollar that we're paid by the state. So for every invoice we submit to Deed, the St. Paul Foundation and the Fry Foundation they don't match it dollar for dollar, but they do match it for nickels and dimes on the dollar. So we have a fair amount of our money that flows to us for performance only.
Representative Poppe. I think Representative Norton first.
I just wanted to follow up. That was my question. Thank you. What amount of career counseling do you do? You talked about the soft skills and developing certain things. What kind of level of counseling is done as far as helping to ascertain what would be of most value and interest for the people who are participating and to choose their career path?
Maybe I'll start with that, then I'll let Andre kind of tell about his experience. The way the program works is you come in and you take a course load of math and writing and computers, and then you take this empowerment class we've talked about, which is really the personal development class. At the same time, when you come into the program, you are expected to get a job. Most people come in unemployed. Most of the people, frankly, are going to get jobs that don't pay very well, tend to be fast food or whatever. But we expect people to work while they're in the job. During that whole time, you have a coach who's been assigned to you. This is a professional employee of Twin Cities Rise, who is working with you on your personal issues and also working with you to help you think through what are the careers that are going to be right for you, because not everybody's right to be a teller, not everybody's right to work in a factory floor. So we begin that assessment process pretty early. I don't know, Andre, if you have anything to add, how it worked for you.
Mm-hmm. We meet with our work skills coach once a week for half an hour. Some sessions can take a little bit longer. And for me, there was, because it's not an easy program to go through. It takes a lot of commitment, and it's hard to see the long term goals that you're going to get, the delayed gratification. So there were days when I really wanted to give up and just go back to old behavior patterns, and I would pull my coach to the side and talk to him, and he always put that positive word in my head, you know, to keep focused, keep going, ask me those open-ended questions that really got me thinking about the choices that I was making. When I first started, you know, we met, he asked me, you know, as far as what career areas I want to go to, what educational background that I have, and just a lot more about myself. And he really has been influential in my life, and I still meet with him once a week, you know, to this day, and he's really a role model.
Thank you. One last comment. It's kind of counterintuitive in a job training program. We actually don't think the career counseling is the most important thing initially. We really believe that having an individual work through their personal issues and have them feel like they're more in control of their emotions, taking more accountability and responsibility for their actions is the base. So that's what we really focus in on that first 3, 4, 5 months someone's with us, is the personal issues.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, testifiers and Representative Mahoney. And 254 is laid on the table then for possible inclusion.
Lay it over for possible inclusion, Mr. Chair?
I'm assuming that motion was made before
yes.
I got
yes.
it.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Representative Mahoney, why don't you just stay there then, and we'll bring up House File 648. And I'm assuming, Representative Mahoney, the unemployment insurance housekeeping bill?
I am getting that as we speak, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney, I guess, is there someone from the Department of Employment and Economic Development here, Mr. Nelson? Mr. Nelson, why don't you just come on up? Did I get a little flustered that night and lay that bill on the table? I can't remember.
Mr. Chair, we laid this bill on the table for the time being, so I move that we take it up off the table.
Well, Representative Mahoney then moves again to that House Bill 648 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. Our Representative I think we can go right to the floor with this, because if we take the amendment off, which I put on the other day, or that's on sitting out there right now, I believe then we can go right to the floor. So
I would ask that the chair allow me to remove my amendment, but I have another amendment that I would like to add. Much nicer amendment.
Do we have the amendment?
It should be in your packet. It's the A070289 amendment. Do we have to make it? We have to make any motion to withdraw my amendment, my first amendment?
I can't remember. Maybe my LA can help me. Did we?
We did not vote on it, Mr. Chair.
Withdraw your amendment. Representative Mahoney withdraws his
previous amendment.
What number was it? Whatever the number amendment.
Whatever
was.
The number was.
Mr. Okay, Chair. Representative Mahoney offers withdraws his amendment. The A070179 amendment, and moves the A070289 amendment, which we all have in front of us.
If I can explain the 89 amendment. Mr. Chair, due to an interpretation in the current unemployment benefits, when someone like myself, who is a union pipe fitter and has to take a job through a union hall, as part of basically our contract, there's really not much point in me going down to one of the workforce centers to go through an hour and a half training class on how to get a job. It's not so much of a real imposition on someone like myself who lives in the inner city, but often people have to drive 40 or 50 miles. And this doesn't cost anything. It's just clarifies some language. That's the way it had been done for the last 15 or 20 years. And it's just in the last year that this has become an issue because of a different interpretation. I'm just clarifying it with this particular amendment.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the department and the unemployment insurance program welcomes this particular amendment.
Mr. Nelson, why would we need this if it's there wasn't any contention, point of contention previously?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was unaware of this being an issue or problem until Representative Mahoney addressed it to me shortly before this meeting. And had we been aware of it, I'm sure we could have taken care of it. But language will ensure that it is properly handled.
Well, members and Mr. Nelson, I gave you a problem and blew the whole bill up. I mean, what's Mahoney better than me or what there?
I just asked nicer. Mr. Chair, this is actually something that's been bubbling around for a while, and there's been so many other things on my plate carrying this particular bill and the others that I didn't get a chance to talk to Mr. Nelson about it previous. So.
I do want to, now that you we have withdrawn the amendment regarding the severance that we've had some, you know, lively discussion on when this bill was before this committee, and, you know, I just do want the members to know that I am still going to pursue this. I'm not going to pursue it on this bill because this bill was agreed upon by labor and the chamber and business, and there's some things in here that have to move because of timelines. But I still say, members, it's totally unfair, Mr. Nelson. What's the fund going to be at the end of the year? What's the projected balance going to be in the UI fund?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it is currently projected to be about $700 million. I might point out that that is $700 million below what the state auditor suggests should be in the balance, but it will have 700. It is projected to be 700 million.
What's the highest total that's been in that fund in the last 10 years?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it had about $720 million in December 2000, but then in March of 2003, it was $443 million in deficit. But as I indicate, Mr. Chairman, it will have $700 million by the end of the year, all things staying current.
Well, I think, Mr. Nelson, it'd be fair to say that in the last decade, that's probably close to the highest we've ever had in there is the $700 million balance. And it's been just in the last decade that the severance issue was put into law.
Mr. Chairman, if you want me to go through the...
No, I don't want to do that today. I'm just throwing some information out there for the members that felt like something got sprung on them the other day, which it kind of did.
Yeah.
Nobody's arguing that point. It's the why is the reason, and it's an issue to be brought up. Because last time, members, you heard the United Auto Workers in here, and you know the pain they're going through. And I think it's totally wrong that there's hardly anyone that qualifies for unemployment insurance getting laid off the Ford Motor Plant because of their severance packages, and that's the issue. And 13 other states don't count it at all, and there's a mixture of how they count it in many of the other states that do, and that's the issue here for me. So, okay. Representative Mahoney?
Well, just in closing, Mr. Chair, I think we've got to get this bill done so that we don't affect people later on this year.
I realize
so,
that.
Hopefully we can move it to the floor and pass it there and ask for your support.
Okay, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, and just that remind members, I believe that we do have the amendment on here for the extending benefits for 13 weeks for Cook County. Is that correct?
For the Ainsworth folks, yes, it's on here.
And Mr. Chair.
Mayor Representative Ruth.
And Representative Mahoney, because I have some questions on that we have left that in this bill. I feel we're really setting a precedent by putting that in here. And I'm just wondering, what is the, do we have any statistics on the rate of finding a job afterwards? I'm wondering why we would be doing this for a particular area when we have, we have issues all over the state.
Mr. Chair, I think.
Let me handle that one, because Representative Ruth, there have been extensions that have been done several times in the state, all over the state. And then when we had the massive layoff that time at LTV, the Ventura administration put some criteria in law, as to when there would be extensions above our normal 26-week extension. And those criteria were worked on by a lot of members who actually, a lot of executive branch folks who had been left over from the Arne Carlson years. So it was done very bipartisanly as to how those, what that criteria would be. And in fact, Ron Abrams and now Commissioner McElroy were very involved in that criteria. So I don't know, I don't think we're going around that with this inclusion in here. It has to do with, there are a number of different factors in that formula. Maybe Mr. Nelson can refresh my memory as to what they are besides geographic and unemployment figures, et cetera. But it's not out of the norm what's going on in this bill right now.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering about this particular area, because as I understand, it looks like one of the plants may be opening. So I'm just curious why in this instance we do need this. Just looking for some clarification.
One of the plants isn't in Representative Moe's district in Bemidji. That one line isn't coming back ever. And those people live in an area where I don't think they can find a job anywhere near this. But
we're hoping some of them do.
We're hoping still maybe that decision will change, but it doesn't look like it. In the Cook area, yeah, they're calling people back there. In the Grand Rapids area, we don't know yet. There's a question as to whether or not they're going to drop off before we're out of this session, too. But Representative Moe's district definitely needs, it's not going to open up again, and those 130-some, I don't know what they are not going to be going back.
Almost 30 of them still unemployed.
No, Mr. Chair, well, I'm certainly sympathetic to that. I mean, that's rough, and it's. But do we have a fiscal note? I don't remember seeing one. Do we know what this?
There is no fiscal note on this because it's in the unemployment insurance fund, which we don't. We don't see fiscal notes on our general fund. The hit to the fund, Mr. Nelson, do you have an estimate that if every single eligible person at Ainsworth took advantage of this, what it would cost?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, our estimate is just over $600,000 one-time cost. But I might point out, in the history of extended special extensions, of which there have probably been 14 or 15 since 1987, we found is about 60% to two-thirds collect. So when we give that $600,000 figure, it is every single person. If history is any guide, it will cost somewhere near about $400,000 total for all the individuals, one-time money.
Okay. Representative Mahoney then renews his motion. House Bill 648 be recommended to pass as amended. Oh, didn't we vote on the amendment yet? Representative Mahoney, the 289 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Now Representative Mahoney renews his motion that House Bill 648 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor to the General Register, as amended twice.
Thank you, Mr.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good job. Representative Mahoney, do you have another bill up?
I do.
Okay. Representative Clark's bill. House Bill 1430.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to recommend that House File 1430 be recommended to pass and be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And, go ahead, Representative Clark.
This will be a very brief presentation. This bill doesn't cost us anything. It does make some changes in the program that makes it work better, and I'd like to ask for my witness here just to talk a little bit about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thomas, and I'm with the Jobs Now Coalition. We're a research and advocacy coalition. We have over 100 organizations statewide. Our research includes the cost of living in Minnesota, which some of you may have seen in hard copy or on our interactive calculator on our website. But our advocacy focuses on employment issues that affect unemployed workers, dislocated workers, low-wage workers, and our members include community-based organizations that provide direct services to those individuals, and social justice organizations, some unions, some faith-based organizations. We don't provide direct services, so I just wanted to make that clear. This bill makes two changes to the Pathways Grant Program, which is one of four grant programs overseen by the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board. And in general, the Job Skills Partnership Grant Programs, the MJSP grant programs, are an economic development tool that focus on upgrading and reskilling workers at a business. And they're partnerships between educational institutions and businesses. It's also the goal of those grants to build capacity in the educational institutions in Minnesota. Specifically, the Pathways Grant Program was intended to use this model of business educational partnerships to create more opportunities for individuals moving off of public assistance, and it was created during welfare reform in 97-98 when the legislature took that issue on. In the year 2000, the target population for the grants was expanded to any individual under 200% of poverty. Because of changes in federal and state welfare and workforce policy, service providers have learned a lot about what works for reemployment and training strategies for people who are stuck in the low-wage labor market. And across the country in Minnesota there's been a lot of piloting and research about what works and what doesn't work. And actually, the Governor's Workforce Development Council, one of their committees, took a look at what program policy and funding changes would help provide more access to low-wage workers to get skill training. And this bill is based on one of the recommendations of the GWDC. And this is their policy advisory, and I think most members of the legislature got it. And this bill is included in those recommendations. So what this bill does is it would do two things. It would expand the pool of eligible entities that could apply for a Pathways grant to what we refer to as workforce development intermediaries. And an intermediary is sort of a set of characteristics of an entity that has been well developed in the workforce development field. And while this expands the pool of applicants for those grants, it doesn't change the standards by which the grants are evaluated or the competitive nature of that grant process. Second, it reduces the employer match from 1-to-1, this is just for the Pathways grants, to 1/2-to-1. The effect of this change would be to incent more smaller businesses to partner in these grants. These businesses are less likely to be able to invest in training entry-level workers. They definitely see the value, but they often can't make the 1-to-1 match requirement. And actually, the Governor's Workforce Development Council's committee recommendation was to eliminate the match, just to require some evidence of employer support. But in subsequent discussions that I've had as an advocate with the staff who run the program, they think it's important to have a specific match in statute because it does demonstrate employer commitment. So that's a brief summary of what's in the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Questions? Who makes the determination? Does the Workforce Development Council make the determination on who has a demonstrated track record in your definition?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be a decision that would be made by the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Board as they're awarding grants. So the process is that grants are made to the applications are made to the staff, and the staff reviews the grant applications and makes recommendations to the full Job Skills Partnership Board, who makes the final decision to make a grant award.
And will the effect of the change in the match mean that less grants are given out, or?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't think that the effect will be that fewer grants. I think the effect will be that more small businesses will participate in the grants. Right now, Most of the grants that are made by the Job Skills Partnership Board in all of their grant programs are generally a partnership between an educational institution and one business. And in order for that business to have a substantial grant, they have to be a large business. They have to, you know, they tend to have anywhere from 80 to 400 employees who are being trained under the grant. It's very rare to see smaller businesses.
And Mr. Chairman, I think it's right now the grant required is one-to-one, isn't that right?
Yes.
So this reduces it so smaller businesses would have more of a chance.
I like the idea and I agree with it. I'm just wondering what the effects are as far as the people served, because it would, if the business is required now to throw in an equal amount.
Mr. Chair,
you're going to lose about a quarter of your money, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the business match can be in kind or cash. So often the business match is wages paid during training, or the business will have some of their staff or supervisors provide instruction, or they'll buy new equipment for the training, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure it would be end up being fewer people. It might be. But I'm not sure that that would be the effect.
Further questions? If not, then this bill will be held over for possible inclusion. And that, I guess, concludes our agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
We don't have any minutes prepared because we went so late last night. So meeting, we'll see you tomorrow. And members, we've got a ton of bills, you know. So we're going to have some packed agendas here and probably a number of evening next week on Monday and Thursday. We have evening meetings. So,
Mr. Chair, I have a three-minute egg timer at home.
With that, members, Representative Gunther is now in the room, meeting adjourned. There you go.